week of December 22nd, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 473, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news-making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I almost lied and said New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Well, why would you have needed to lie? Just last week, you were telling us you were going to Birmingham, Alabama to spend the holidays with your family and to take care of your mother.
Well, I almost forgot where I was. I almost said I was in New York again instead of remembering where I was, which is Birmingham, Alabama. Happy Hanukkah.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Happy Kwanzaa. Happy winter solstice. It all is quiet on New Year's Eve, as Bono would say. We'll have a show next week, so it won't be that quiet because we will be in your home talking and arguing about the holiday box office.
Right. For at least, like, what, 2 to 3 hours, right? I mean, if it's a normal show.
That's right. Has my package arrived yet, Sperling? My traditional holiday gift for you, has it arrived yet? It's very big. It's very big. You know, has it gotten there yet? I know you've sent one to me, I'm sure.
Yeah, don't know. Yeah, you're breaking up. I can't hear you.
Well, all I want for Christmas is another number one hit for Mariah Carey. She's number one for the second week in a row. And at number two on the Billboard charts is Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree by Brenda Lee. I love it. Because I love seeing the songs that people are actually listening to reflected on the charts, just like the movies they watch, and as it should be, but it's not, the books that they're reading and buying. So it's great to see that the changes in the chart reflect the music that's actually being played. You know what? It's only once a year for 2 weeks where you suddenly get holiday songs popping back on the charts. All I Want for Christmas will be back on the charts next year. It happened in the 40s and 50s for 20 years with Bing Crosby, so get used to it. At least it's accurately reflecting what people are listening to. Someday we'll get that with TV ratings, but right now we don't even know what people are watching.
Well, you know, you talked about books and about what people are reading. Did you see that article in the New York Times over the weekend about Delia Owens and her book, Where the Crawdads Sing? I mean,
that's a monster hit. Yeah,
she's a debut novelist at the age of 70.
Well, that's funny because I was just remembering Helen Hoover Santmeyer, who was a debut novelist at 88 years old with a massive novel called And the Ladies of the Club. There's an ellipsis before that. It's like dot, dot, dot. And the Ladies of the Club. And it was a big, fat Southern novel with gossip and dreaming. And it was a huge sensation. She was 88. It was in the early 1980s. She was on all the morning talk shows. You know, this lovable little old lady who'd been working on this novel for decades. And it finally came out the same year that my college professor, I didn't know him at the time, but Paget Powell, had his debut novel out, Edisto. That was both nominated for the National Book Award, and he just was gritting his teeth because obviously there was no way you were going to beat an adorable 88-year-old lady with her debut novel. So his chance to win the National Book Award was snatched out of his hands.
Well, I just found it a fascinating story because it kind of begins with, there was this woman. She was kind of like a scientist or, you know, like an anthropologist. And then she like wrote this book and the publisher was like, it's probably not going to sell a lot. Print only 28,000 copies. They've had to go back to the printer 40 times.
Of course. Yeah. It's been a big hit, a big book club hit. One of those word of mouth hits. It's feast or famine in books. It's very hard to break through. But now that she's broken through, she'll probably be a brand name novelist for years to come if she can capitalize on that success. But you're seeing feast or famine at the movies. Feast or famine in music. I think, though, with TV, it's not feast or famine because there's so many shows and there's so many ways for people to add up dollars and eyeballs that I think you're seeing more of a spreading of the wealth in TV. Maybe that's happening with music, too, now. It used to be feast or famine, but we do see Harry Styles is at the number one of the album charts with his new album. I think it's called Fine Lines, but that debuted huge. I think it was one of the biggest debuts in 2 years, and at least in his genre. It was bigger than his debut album when that came out. So the former One Direction guy is just doing great as a solo act. So that's what's happening.
I wouldn't recognize any of his music, to be honest.
It's dad music. He's got a 70s vibe to him. You maybe want to check it out.
Oh, actually, I know. I take that back. I would. Yes, you're right.
Sign of the Times was a really good single, I thought.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but I would rather sing Christmas songs, but we don't have time for that. Maybe at the end of the show, we could do a few carols. But before we do, tell us what we're going to talk about.
Well, can you tell we're just vamping, by the way, because there's not a lot of news this week and we still need to make the show 9 hours long?
Yeah, people are saying you don't need to vamp. Just keep going.
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we discover that China really doesn't give a hoot about Star Wars. you know, they don't give other stuff too, but we are a family show. We probably knew that, by the way, but is the rest of the world losing interest in Star Wars as well? Don't jump to conclusions just yet. We do know that one of the biggest art house circuits in the UK has been snapped up. A little aside to that story when we get there. In China, that country's box office has hit record highs with less than 2 weeks to go in the year, and they did it mostly with homegrown hits. On Inside Baseball, we take a dive into Netflix. 1 minute ago, investors were bailing because Netflix was losing subscribers in North America during their slowest quarter of the year. Now, they've released info for every major territory in the world, and investors are, well, they're jumping back on board. Fickle fellows, aren't they? Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
No, oh, wait, on last week's pause. Box office.
On last week's, you know what? You almost said you were in New York. I can't get last weekend's box office out of my mind.
Well,
but please, Michael, tell us what happened in last week's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office for the last 7 days. We pull a link from ComScore. That's the basis for our chart, and we've got a link to them in our show notes. But then we pull information from everywhere else, from Deadline and the numbers and box office profit to the trades, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, the major newspapers. We also look at overseas charts. We have a Bollywood chart, and Sperling shared a Chinese market chart that I've been looking at today. And I noticed that that Chinese chart covers the week's entire grosses. It does not present the weekend's box office. It presents the last 7 days, just like we do. So maybe, just maybe, people are waking up to, you know, hey, why are we ignoring 4 or 5 days of the week? It makes no sense. Maybe it's catching on all over the world.
Well, in China, it's partly because movies open, they don't all open on one day. They'll open, you know, just randomly throughout the week.
They're a little more random, but they, just like in North America, where movies open up on Thursday or Tuesday, or, you know, they open up all sorts of days too. So that's very cool. So we're looking at the worldwide box office for the last 7 days. And of course, the big news at number one, Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. It's always nice to make your box office on opening week, especially when your budget is $300 million. And that's exactly what happened with Star Wars. It opened around the world to $375 million, very little of it from China.
Yeah, you know, so last week I didn't make the all media screening. It was like, you know, there was one of my kids had a recital. So I went to that instead.
What was she or he playing? Or she?
Trumpet.
Oh, very loud.
Actually, sorry, viola. Was viola.
Trumpet or viola? You don't know what instrument
you know,
your child
two
plays?
Different kids. I can't remember which was. Like, there's a lot of recitals
at
this time.
And what was
year.
The piece?
They played a whole bunch of stuff. Plays viola and electric bass.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's going to be a cool rock band someday.
Exactly.
So you missed the all-media screening.
But then I like turned on Twitter that night, and oh my God, you would have thought that you know, Disney just took Darth Vader by the neck and just strangled him. Because people did not like this movie. At least the critics that I was reading were like, oh, God. They didn't give any spoilers away, and I still haven't seen the movie, so please don't tell me anything that happened. But
it's the plot twist of the movie that people are disappointed with. It was just, I just felt a major indifference. I took my nephews and my sister Leslie. We all went to the movie together in the middle of the day, and it was just like, oh, there it was, and it was done. You know, you just felt very indifferent, I have to say. I do like the look and production design of it. The look of it was great. It felt real, like the classic original Star Wars. Those decisions to have practical effects whenever possible and to build sets, it really pays off because it really does feel lived in. And there were some cool set pieces in the movie, but the overall story is like, whatever.
Do you think that maybe they played it too safe? That they were just trying to squeeze everything into this last.
Well, they played it safe with the last two, and they made, you know, almost $2 billion or $2 billion at the worldwide box office. You know, it's 9 films into a series of the same story stretched out again and again and repeating itself. So, you know, once you hit the 9th film, you can't expect, you know, they'll only make $1 billion. You know, so we'll have to see where it ends up worldwide. North America made a lot of money. Will word of mouth be so bad that people don't return? It opened up a little lower than the last two. Meaning the two in the trilogy, you know, it's going to be fine. Obviously, it's going to gross at least $1 billion worldwide. Maybe it won't make $2 billion like the other one. Maybe it'll make $1.5 billion, you know, but it's going to be fine. And really, as I think it was the Hollywood Reporter said, maybe the future for Star Wars, just like the original sort of set the pace for Hollywood blockbusters and making B movies with A movie budgets. Maybe the future for Star Wars is Mandalorian. We don't know how well that's doing on Disney Plus, but I'm hearing good buzz about that. You know, the best Star Wars in the last 20, 30 years have been the Star Wars Clone Wars animated series, the Rebels series, both cartoons. And I'm hearing pretty fun stuff about Mandalorian. So, you know, Star Wars isn't going anywhere. You've had dozens, if not 100 plus books based in that universe, video games, movies. There will be more films. They're going to give it a break. And now it'll be a whole new clear, you know, they're going to clear the chalkboard and just start fresh. And as far as I'm concerned, there are all tons of great stories in those novels that they can draw upon that they know work and succeed without having to dip back into the well of Luke and Leia. They're not going to do that. But there is a lot of great material that they can draw upon to tell new stories that feel rooted in that world. I think they're going to be just fine. And number two around the world is Jumanji, The Next Level. That made $100 million last week. It's at $312 million worldwide.
Another film that didn't do well in China. And, you know, we kind of mentioned that it didn't do well in China.
Well, they bum-rushed it out. They bum-rushed it out a little bit. You know, so they moved up its release date 1 week, gave them less chance to do promotional work. And, of course, as we get to, well, we'll talk about China's box office in a minute, but they are not trying to help Hollywood movies. They want to help their own films, and they're certainly right. doing that here. At number
Why do you think Star Wars didn't do well? I think we all know why.
We know that it's never been a big game. You know, Star Wars was big before China was showing international films that much. They were never had a lot of exposure. Even the first, you know, the second three movies, the trilogy of Phantom Menace, etc. None of those played big in China. So they just really haven't been exposed to it. So they're sort of joining late in the game and they never caught up. They're happy with the Marvel Universe. Those do great for China. But the Star Wars movies have never been big players. So there was no reason to think this one would be, especially since you see a modest decline in interest in the rest of the world. So right. Why wouldn't they follow suit? But they do like Disney Plus and animated films. Frozen 2 made another $100 million last week, just like Jumanji. It's at $1,103 million worldwide. So that will absolutely equal the grosses of the first Frozen film. And again, that wasn't a franchise. It was an original story. So now they've maybe created a franchise, but they're taking their time and they have really scored with this one. At number four is another franchise. It's in China. It's Ip Man 4, the finale. Donnie Yen is back as Ip Man. It cost $52 million to make. And just like Star Wars, it grossed its budget in its first week. It made about $52 million, virtually all of it in the Chinese market. At number five, that's, by the way, a prequel. So that is the end of the Ip Man series for now. They'll probably recreate Ip Man again down the road, but it's a prequel set in the early days of the 70s with Ip Man interacting with Bruce Lee and fighting with other people in America. So it's kind of fun to see Bruce Lee is back on the screen in China, but not in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. At number five is another Chinese film. It's a crime drama called Sheep Without a Shepherd. That's about the family trying to cover up the accidental killing of a brutal rapist that was attacking one of them. That grossed $47 million this week. That's at $77 million and counting. Doing great during the holiday season. Though I don't know if China has a big holiday season. I mean, it's the end of the year. People have holidays because it's not the Chinese New Year, but people do have a bit of a break. But obviously, it's not like Christmas in North America and a lot of the other parts of the world. You don't know, I guess. All right.
I don't. No.
But if our viewers know, please let us, you know, tell us.
Oh, yes. You can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
That's right. Now, Sheep Without a Shepherd is an original film. I don't think it's based on any other property. Maybe it's based on a novel or something, but I didn't notice that. But here's another original film. It's Knives Out, the Agatha Christie-like mystery comedy. It grossed $23 million last week. That's at $185 million worldwide. So that's a big success story. And we've got a bunch of other movies on the chart that are original and scoring doing well. Right below that is Ashfall. This is a Korean disaster flick. There's a volcano that goes off. That may sound familiar because there is a Chinese disaster flick called Skyfire. That also involves a volcano blowing up. But Skyfire seems to be just a traditional disaster flick. But in this Korean movie, from what I gather in the trailer, there's a terrible earthquake / volcano. So there's an earthquake eruption. They realize the volcano is about to go up. And so they get some crazy guy out of prison, like Dirty Dozen, to help get some missiles, blow them up in the volcano to stop the whole country from imploding. So it's some crazy like last mission with desperate convicts and, you know, people banding together to stop the real disaster from happening. So that looks like the plot of that movie. It opened up and it too grossed its budget on opening week. It cost about $18 million to make and it opened to about $18 million. That's in Korea. And number eight is one of the big flops of the year. It's not an original film. It's based on one of the biggest musicals of all time. It ain't not easy to make a big musical out of a Broadway show for lots of reasons. And Cats has nine of them. Cats is not doing well. It opened up to $11 million. And this is fascinating, isn't it? Cats is not done yet.
That's right. You know, they asked me to do a few lines in the movie. I'm sure they're going to be swinging through.
I mean, they have put out a notice. Oh, by the way, we're still working on these special effects. We're going to have a new print available digitally. People will have gotten it today. Those who need one copy sent to them, that will arrive tomorrow on Tuesday. We are recording on Monday right now, December 23rd. So on Christmas Eve, as a little gift, there will be a new version available pretty much in the entire North American country and I assume around the world of Cats. So if you saw it within its first 5 or 6 or 7 days, you haven't seen the finished version. They're still working on it. That's crazy. That is crazy.
Well, I think it's the effects. They did not get the effects.
But that's crazy that they did not budget enough time to do it properly. You know, doing it at the last minute and still, they
Well, I think they changed a few things after the backlash.
Well, but that's, you know, they didn't need a rocket scientist to tell them it wasn't looking great. But I don't think it was so much a backlash as they also knew that they were going to be working up to the last minute. And that was cutting it too tight. This is a movie that's a musical property that's been around for decades. There's no reason you shouldn't have enough time budgeted to do everything you need to make it look right. That's a studio mistake. That's not Tom Hooper. That's his name, right? Tom Hooper?
Tom Hooper.
Yeah, that is the studio's problem for not budgeting or forcing them to go into production and start filming without having enough time between the end of filming and its release date. That's
well, I think they thought they did have enough time, and then all of a sudden there was this giant backlash of how these.
Yeah,
cats
but you see, you see other movies. They've got like a year of post production, 8 months. Not, I mean, you know, it's all post production in this because they're Cats. At number nine is another new.
You know, they say there is no such thing as bad publicity. But there was there was an article in the Washington Post about all of the best bad reviews of Cats. Like they were kind of quoting all the bad reviews and like what different critics said about Cats.
And of course, musicals have long legs. They tend to run for a while. They don't open big. This is a huge, well-known property. People over 55, older people, have really liked this movie. In fact, just yesterday, my mother and I were visiting a friend in Birmingham who a gazebo fell on her.
What? But
she's doing okay. And she's getting up and about now. And she had seen Cats. Oh, I love Judi Dench, she said. And oh, she was wonderful. It was really good. So older audiences are responding to it. But in general, the scores are very poor. So audiences aren't liking it. Critics aren't liking it. It won't be a complete disaster because that $11 million is over just the first few days. And it will do better over the next 10 days. But it's not going to be enough to make it a hit. You never know. We'll have to see worldwide. But certainly the news isn't good when most fans and critics are not happy with the movie. You're in trouble. At number nine is a movie people are kind of liking. It's called Only Cloud Knows. It's a Chinese tearjerker about a man who's widowed, returns to New Zealand for some reason. Maybe his wife is from there. It's not quite clear to me. But he returns to New Zealand and finds out his wife had secrets, a secret past. But I think it'll be all sad and lovely at the end. But I don't know. But it opened to $11 million in China. And number 10 is a big Indian action comedy flick. It's Dabang. It's Dabang 3. It opened to about $10 million. It's very funny trailer. He said, there are outlaws and there are cops, but I'm an outlaw cop. And he's running around and looks, there's dancing, there's singing, there's humor. It opened to about $10 million, including here in Birmingham, Alabama. That's the reach of the Desi audience. They're all over the world. So these movies are now playing all over the world. And that's cool to see. At number 9 is another original film. It's Emma Thompson's Last Christmas. It made another $10 million. It's at $110 million worldwide.
And that was number 11, not number 9.
Number 11. At number 12 is another film for adults and kids who like cars, Ford versus Ferrari. That's at just under $200 million worldwide. We still think that's going to get to $300 million when all is said and done. We think it'll be a player come Oscar time. So that movie is in good shape. Here's another movie that just opened up. It's a Chinese comedy romance. It's called Almost a Comedy. And you can see that if you look at the trailer, because at first it's young people and one guy plays a guitar. He's really, you know, he's another dreamy Chinese guy playing the acoustic guitar. This seems to be a trend in Chinese films. And these three young people are all laughing. Then they're fighting and then they're crying. So a lot happens in the movie. I'm not quite sure what, but they go from laughing to fighting to crying. I hope it works out well in the end. But that opened up to $7 million. Right below that is Black Christmas, a slasher flick, a remake from one from the 70s, I think, or the early 80s. That's at $13 million and counting, but it only cost $5 million to make, so that's going to be okay. Then there's, is that right? I don't think that's right. I forgot to erase a film that shouldn't be up there anymore. I think that movie is gone. You know, I make the charts up every week, so I don't always do a great, perfect job. So I believe the next movie, I found this on the Chinese chart. It's called The Warrior of Hornor. And it's a Chinese film. I couldn't find a trailer. I couldn't find any information except on IMDb. It says it opened December 5th. Now, it makes no sense that this movie would make most of its money this week if it opened up 2.5 weeks ago. But from the Chinese chart Sperling gave me, it shows that it made about $7 million this week. And it's at $15 million total. It's not on the Comscore charts. I couldn't find any info about it. So maybe that company has it wrong or the name is not being translated properly. If you know more, let us know. We just gave you the information. There's another new movie right below that, a Korean comedy. So you can see China and Korea are really big territories, and India, when it comes to original movies that can break onto the worldwide charts. They've got a strong local audience. They make really good movies, and those movies can travel around the world. Maybe this one will do it. It's called Startup. It doesn't seem to be about a tech company. It seems to be about this loser teenager who gets beat up by everybody. And then he gets this weird chef who becomes maybe a mentor or a menace. It's funny. It's light. Hopefully the kid doesn't keep getting beat up, but it opened up to $6 million.
I want to know where I can see some of these darn movies. I can't see them anywhere.
I'm sure you can steal them online because was it one third of all Indonesians have access to pirated website? I was reading some stat about that when people are talking about fighting piracy. You want to make these movies available. You can see Dabang 3 in the cinemas in North America. You can see a lot of these Chinese films and AMC chains in major cities, at least. Startup, I hope, will come to us too. You know, these Korean movies should translate pretty well. One movie that may or may not translate is Bombshell. This is another movie that opened up over the holidays here in North America. It's about the sexual harassment and sexual beyond that, but scandal at Fox News. It involves some of our biggest female stars, including Nicole Kidman. It opened up to $5 million. So this is a film for adults. It should have long legs. When people looked at Star Wars and said, oh, this new edition opened up a little bit lower and all that, it has to do a little bit with when the holiday falls in the middle of the week. That can throw off these numbers. Of course, when the holiday falls in a great spot, that means you have the most chance to get people building it up and to the holidays. When a holiday falls on a Wednesday, for example, it can sometimes throw people off. They need to shop, they need to see family, and then suddenly it's the weekend and people are traveling. So the holiday does not always cooperate with the big box office, but people will keep going to Star Wars and they will go to Bombshell. So it only opened up to $5 million, but it has very good reviews. Well, no, it doesn't. Now that it's open wide, early on it had some good Oscar buzz and it probably will be a player with the women, but the reviews now don't look great. They're kind of middling. It's like, you know.
Well, better than Cats and Star Wars.
Well, that's true. That's true. It is higher than Cats and Star Wars, but it's not way up there in terms of strong critical acclaim. But adults may respond to it. You really want to hold off your judgment because it grossed $5 million and it only cost about $30 million to make. Richard Jewell, the Clint Eastwood film, that's right below it. That clearly is not going to click. It's at $9 million worldwide. I'm not sure this will play well overseas because Clint Eastwood is not in it, so he's not going to be a draw. It's a story most countries have not heard of. It hasn't done well critically or commercially, so it's probably already been pre-sold. It will open around the world, but it's probably not going to be a big player. But it did cost $45 million to make. Can it get to $130 million worldwide? I doubt it, but you know, withhold judgment. But Bombshell at least has some good name recognition with the women in it. And they at least are getting good critical acclaim and could be players come Oscar time. Richard Jewell looks like it's going to fall off the charts. That's our worldwide box office. I love that Cats is not done yet. I was going to go see it over the weekend. I did see Star Wars, but I held off on Cats because I don't want to go and then say, oh, you should have seen the refined version. That's much better. You know?
So well, it's the same length. Okay, so it's literally
right,
the same
running time. Special effects.
Yeah, so,
I wanted to wait for the right special effects. I will not, however, see it in IMAX because it was not filmed in IMAX. Unless most or all the film was filmed in IMAX, there is no reason to spend a premium price to see the movie. But people are doing that all over the world, aren't they?
Would you go see Star Wars in IMAX if only so that you could see the opening of Tenet?
I did see the trailer for Tenet. That's the new Christopher Nolan film. It looked very cool. And how fascinating that Robert Pattinson is a co-star in it, and he's barely mentioned. You don't even see him in this first trailer. It's all about John David Washington. Is that his name?
John, yes.
Yeah,
correct. Denzel Washington's son.
Who was great in the Spike Lee film. And he looks cool here. But that's an interesting marketing thing to notice that he is the first name and he's virtually the only person you see in this big, substantial 2-minute trailer. Robert Pattinson, one of the more famous actors in the world, is glimpsed through a piece of glass and his name is not dramatically well displayed. That's a pretty ballsy signs of the time move by the studio behind that movie. So that's interesting.
But they're also showing like the first, the opening sequence.
Oh, I see.
In IMAX.
Oh, I was just talking about the trailer. It was the film shot in IMAX? It was, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. Are you kidding me? Not only was it shot in IMAX, at least most of it, but Christopher Nolan at the end of the trailer, which most people, let's face it, watched online, right?
Uh-huh.
Were on their phones. Ugh, that just irks me. But, at the very end of the trailer, even before the credit block, it says, for maximum effect, view this trailer in a movie theater.
Oh, yes, they did. They did plug that. I had watched it on my phone because I wanted to see it. And then I watched it again in front of Star Wars. So, no, I won't go to Star Wars again just to see that 5 minutes or whatever. Besides, I don't like seeing 5 minutes of a movie. I want to see the movie. I know you do that all the time with Show West, but I want to see the film when it comes out. That one I will see in IMAX. And in fact, IMAX had a record year. It grossed $1 billion worldwide at IMAX theaters. This is before Star Wars 9 opened, before Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker. So it still has like 10 days to go of box office grosses. It has already set an all-time record. Here's the interesting fact. The three biggest picks in IMAX theaters all over the world, Avengers Endgame, no surprise, Wandering Earth, the Chinese sci-fi flick, and Noja, the Chinese animated film, to which I go, what can we draw from that information?
They're opening a lot of IMAX screens in China. That's what you can infer.
And also,
which is, by the way, true.
And also, IMAX is still more popular overseas, is now much more popular overseas than it is in North America. That trend line with 3D has also happened with IMAX. You're not going to be making this money in 5 years on IMAX screens. Unless a movie shot in IMAX, I don't think people are going to pay premium prices. But right now, it's still a novelty. People are still excited by it. And it's still working overseas. And that's why you're seeing two of the three biggest hits being Chinese films rather than Hollywood films. Do you agree?
Yeah, I think that you won't see the same drop off as
in North America. You think they're going to still stay loyal? Why?
Well, no. Meaning, I don't think you're going to see the same drop off as 3D. 3D just like off a cliff,
right?
Numbers. I think it might go down, but it's not going to disappear entirely.
Well, I rarely hear people talking about IMAX grosses in North America anymore, and I assume it's for the same reason they stopped talking about 3D, because there wasn't a lot of great news to sell.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to talk
Well, surely they'll report the annual grosses for North America in IMAX, won't they?
Yeah, I would hope so.
Well, you should find that out. So from the biggest screens in the world, which are IMAX, assuming they are actually official IMAX screens and not just branded that way, which is not a thing they should do, let's go to some of the smallest screens, not in terms of size necessarily, but in terms of the type of film they're presenting. And that's the art house circuit. There was a lot of big news coming out of the UK this week.
Yeah, on Friday, I was speaking to some folks at CJ. I won't say who. That way it doesn't, I'm not giving up, giving away anybody.
We already gave away the company.
Yeah, well, but there's a lot of people there.
Okay.
That said, I was told, hey, keep this under your hat, but Curzon Cinemas is for sale. That was Friday, okay?
Haven't they been on sale for a while?
I don't think so.
One of the articles said it had been in play for like a year.
Oh, well, they're always in play, but
Well, I'm not in play. Are you in play?
I'm not in play.
Actually, I am in play.
Okay, I don't even know what we're talking about anymore.
Call me.
888-567-SAN. That said, literally, I was told Friday and then on Monday it's sold to, you know, Cohen Media Group, the same company that bought Landmark Theaters here in the U.S.
So Cohen Media Group is an American company owned by a billionaire who loves movies. And he started a label to do sort of Criterion-like releases of old films. Then he has bought some art houses. It's all passion for him, really. I mean, he assumes it's going to be a good business and doesn't want to lose his money. But it's because he has a love for cinema. Now he has bought Landmark Cinema in North America, kicked out the guy who was running it, which is a questionable move, but there you go. And now he has purchased the premier, is it the premier art house exhibitor in the UK, Curzon Cinemas?
Say that again?
Are they the premier exhibitor of art house movies in the UK? They have 20 theaters with 46 screens. Is there any other art house circuits that's bigger than them?
Well, you could go to Picture House. You could also go to Everyman Cinemas. Those are two cinemas that, like Landmark, will show big Hollywood blockbusters, but they would also show smaller independent fare.
So is Curzon more like the Angelica Cinemas, if you're trying to think of a North American equivalent?
Exactly, because they are one of the few theater chains, if not the only theater chain, that would play Netflix films. So because they have a distribution arm known as Artificial Eye, they would play these direct to streaming titles in the theater.
Well, Curzon is a vertically integrated company. Talk about the Paramount decree, but they own cinemas, they own a distributor, Artificial Eye, and they own a streamer. So in the UK, they make the movies, they show the movies in cinemas, and then they stream them into your homes.
Yes, correct.
So isn't that a vertically?
Yes, although it's a much smaller, you know, it would be like if Criterion's, you know,
right,
started releasing
or you
films
and I, but nonetheless, they've got 46 screens, so that's cool. Artificial Eye, by the way, they've been around for a long time. I think Curzon acquired them in about 2006. They have won the Oscar for Best International Film for 7 of the past 8 years. They have had a piece of the movie that won it. Like, they didn't make a separation necessarily, or maybe they funded it, I don't know. But they did acquire
it.
They picked it up and acquired it. So they've been a big player in the art house world for a few years now. So cool to see. So what does this mean that Cohen Media Group has acquired them? Are they developing the worldwide equivalent to AMC or Wanda to have like the biggest art house chain in the world?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I wonder if what you're seeing here is brands starting to be developed around certain types of content. Like vintage classics, mm-hmm, in publishing, whether you're going to have the Cohen Media Group basically start these, or not start, but kind of roll up all of these independent cinemas and allow them to show different types of content other than big blockbusters.
Right. So like that's like having the Sundance Channel or the IFC Channel.
Exactly.
They're saying
you explained it in a much better and more concise way.
Okay. Yes. Well, so IMAX had a record year at the box office worldwide. We'll have to check out what they did in North America and what the trend lines are there. Cohen Media Group had a big year. They ended it with a big bang by acquiring the Curzon, theater chain, a distributor, and a streaming service, which is available, I think, in the UK. Maybe they'll expand worldwide.
Did they also get the streaming service, or was it the theater?
They got Curzon Cinemas, Curzon Streaming, or whatever it's called, and Artificial Eye, the distributor.
I did not realize that it was.
They bought the whole shebang because it's all owned by Curzon Group or whatever it's called.
Okay.
So yeah, they acquired all three according to the trades that I read. But it's also a big year at the Chinese box office, isn't it?
Yes, it looks like they will, China, the box office will be, it's already surpassed the record, and it's now $8.67 billion, and that was 2 weeks ago. So,
or just
knows?
About 2 weeks before the end of the year.
Right. Oh, okay.
So they hit a record of 61 billion renminbi. But the target, however, was 65 billion renminbi. So they still have 4 billion renminbi to go. And they're hoping to hit that as well. And interestingly enough, we can see that the government, there's been rumors, though as of the 22nd or 3rd, it hasn't happened yet, but the government may allow the release of the banned film 800 because they want to hit the final target. They want to boost the box office for the last, you know, 5-7 days.
One way to do that is to say, you know that film you couldn't see? You can see it right now.
That's
and
right.
Just have everybody race to go see it before they pull it from theaters.
Well, it worked for Better Days, which was banned and then became one of the biggest hits of the year. And we do know the top 10 films in China, only two of them are from Hollywood. That's the Avengers Endgame at number 3. And at number 10 is Hobbs and Shaw, the Fast and Furious spinoff. Other than that, all the films on the list are Chinese homegrown hits, including Better Days, Days at number 9, The Bravest, which is that firefighter movie, at number 8, and number 7 was Pegasus. That's the film about a race car driver directed and starring Han Han, who is sort of the Chinese Elon Musk slash Tony Stark. Number 6 was Crazy Alien, a broad comedy. Number 5 was The Captain, that movie about a pilot who safely landed a plane during an emergency. And number 4 was My People, My Country, the omnibus film that was made by a number of top filmmakers. Avengers was number 3. Wandering Earth, the big sci-fi hit, was number 2. That's available on Netflix worldwide. And at number 1 was Noja, the animated film. So you can see they had a big breakthrough in animation. They're starting to get closer to having animation that can compete on a worldwide scale. They had a big hit with a sci-fi film that has not played overseas. It only aired on Netflix. But obviously, when they're breaking through in that genre, and they have comedies, dramas, period flicks. So they are really creating quality films that someday soon are going to break out worldwide, I think. I mean, why not? Korea can have hits all over the world, that we should be seeing more of them. There's no reason when they make a good film like Wandering Earth that has quality as well as better special effects, or they make another Noja that keeps raising the bar in animation, that these movies should travel. I mean, Miyazaki can travel. There's no reason why these Chinese films can't. So they're really starting to create a good broad range of films. And it'll be interesting to see if they can break into other territories. I don't see any reason why they shouldn't.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens is that, you know, the whole trade dispute with China, between the China and the U.S. And let's face it, China is a part of the World Trade Organization, yet they do actually prevent movies from being shown in China. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out now that the Chinese films are doing so well.
Yeah, they never should have been in the WTO until they were ready to follow the rules. Instead, they were allowed in with the hope that they would then follow the rules, which makes no sense. But we are seeing they're having big hits mostly without Hollywood. They are sort of hobbling Hollywood films, not helping them out, giving them release dates at the last. So they want that box office, but to do it begrudgingly, and they always stack the deck for their own films. We're seeing more and more Hollywood films. We had a story in Variety or Hollywood Reporter about the Chinese films that were Chinese releases that were buyouts, meaning they bought a foreign film outright and then released it locally, and therefore it did not count as far as the quota. So the quota has basically fallen. Films are being bought outright and then shown in that country, like Capernaum, which was a huge art house hit. So they're letting these movies in. They need the box office. We're going to have to see if Hollywood can keep knocking on that door and get better and better access. When they do, I think Chinese films are good enough that they should be able to hold their own. So it will not mean that their movies don't succeed. It just means they'll get, you know, more play out of all the theaters they've been building. And when they do, I think it'll be a big deal for Hollywood because they need that market.
Ooh, well, that's going to be a big deal for Hollywood. I wonder if any of the stories in our Big Deal, Big Whoop segment will, be the same.
I wonder.
Big Deal, Big Whoop is our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Here's our first story. The Comedy Central animated hit South Park, speaking of China, it remains a massive hit. It topped the key demos of 18 to 49 in all of cable for a 7th year in a row. People consumed some 30 billion minutes of South Park in 2019.
I did half of that.
Yeah, wow. Okay, you've got a lot of time on your hands. Now, that's a 30% jump over 1 year earlier.
Wow.
I hope you're sitting down, Michael.
Hold on a second. Okay, I'm sitting down.
Okay, that 30 billion minutes of South Park consumption does not include streaming.
That's impossible. That just blows my mind, doesn't it? That's insane. Yeah.
Now, HBO Max ponied up $500 million for streaming rights for the next few years, so somebody is going to keep Killing Kenny for years to come. Big Deal or Big Whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. It's been a big hit for a long time. We knew it. It's nice to be reminded. But the terms of like why it grew 30% last year, even though it doesn't include streaming, I have no idea what's going on. Maybe that includes their website views. I mean, that seems mind blowing. But and then I saw some numbers. Friends hit $32 billion minutes of viewing time last year worldwide, I think. Is that must be worldwide. But I'm not sure if that includes streaming. The Office hit 52 billion minutes. So you get these.
And by the way, my kids are like at least 30 billion minutes of that. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
It's unbelievable. They just keep watching it over and over again. And I'm like, look, watch something else. Watch anything else. Seinfeld. Watch anything but the... You've already seen it 3 times.
They love it.
They're like, you know what they said? Okay, I'll watch Stranger Things again.
So this is cool. My nephews like South Park. And I mentioned something about the show and we talked about it for a minute. And he said, oh, they're so sick of it. They hate it. They're so frustrated that they keep making it. I'm like, they can do whatever they want. If they said, you know what, we're done, they may have a contract. But if they said to Comedy Central, actually, we're done, we're ending the show now, they wouldn't continue the show. They would just say, okay, thank you for everything. I mean, they would keep the door open and beg them to keep making it. But, you know, at this stage, they may have a contract, but I'm assuming I'm not being silly in Hollywood terms. If those two guys actually said, you know what, we're done, I assume Comedy Central would say, we're so sorry. If you ever want to come back, of course. And what else do you want to make? And do you want to make a movie? And, you know, let us know, guys. But they would not continue the show without them or force them and say, you have a contract. Right at this point, they're too powerful, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, Matt Stone and Trey Parker. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
They have a little empire.
Yep.
Now, your telephone company, big deal or big whoop? No, just kidding. Your telephone company is not responsible if you plan a murder on their phone lines.
Thank goodness.
I mean, maybe you and I should plan a murder right now via podcast. Who would be responsible?
Right? Maybe an internet service provider.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Internet service providers do bear responsibility for copyright infringement that they can see, that they have been warned about, and that they do not stop. That's the takeaway from a court case in which Cox Communications was fined $1 billion for copyright infringement. That's about a $100,000 fine for every one of the 10,000 plus cases of infringement. The jury agreed that Cox had ample information about flagrant violations by specific users and failed to take adequate action to stop it. Sony Music, Universal Music, Warner Music, and EMI all took part in the suit, the latest in which music publishers are finding more success by placing pressure on ISPs rather than on individual users. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. They had a strategy. They used to send letters to individual users and say, hey, stop what you're doing. I have a relative who received one from a major Hollywood studio saying, hey, you're pirating our stuff. You maybe want to stop that.
And did they put it right next to their jury summons for jury duty?
And so that can scare some people. But most people were just ignoring it. And then they realized, you know what? Most of it's being done by a very small handful of people. We can identify who those people are and we can go to the ISPs and say, hey, block these people. This isn't some guy watching movies. This is somebody creating massive libraries for other people to stream and steal and all that. So they're being smarter and saying, look, ISPs, we know you can't stop everyone who does everything, just like YouTube can't stop every person who posts Purple Rain, but you can stop, you know, these 500 people that we tell you about who are actually doing 90% of the damage. And so that's the strategy they've been using. Cox was not taking enough action, and they proved that in court. This is going to make Cox have to change their ways, right? $1 billion is real money.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. This will be appealed.
Of course.
And it's going to go, because basically, technically, Cox is actually, you know, there's some question about how
responsible they are.
Exactly.
Well, I agree. I mean, I don't think an internet provider is responsible for what I post on my blog, you know, but, you know, an individual person. But if you have an egregious person that is doing something to an extreme amount and you've been told about it repeatedly and don't take action against that, then you're just being flagrantly disinterested. I mean, then that's not something like, well, you've got 100,000 people, you know, downloading an album, which happens, but you've got one guy downloading 1 million albums and you're not willing to stop them.
Well,
then
yeah,
I think you're going to have to start bearing responsibility.
Well, and it'll be interesting to see as this case makes its way through the courts just how liable they are. It's the same concept of, you know, there was an article in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago, about all of the child pornography that is on Facebook, and that Facebook is doing very little about it until cases are brought before the courts. And then all of a sudden they're like, well, we better do something about this.
Right. I mean, it's not always easy, but in some cases when you've got, you know, big players and you can stop them, then you start to have a little less empathy for the providers. You don't want them to be the policeman and the watchdog for everybody. And, you know, and they can't be responsible for everybody, but when they have been warned about specific, and it's real and agree, you know, the problem before was they'd go to YouTube for every stupid, you know, we'd post a trailer and we would get a takedown notice, which clearly the system was failing. In this case, I think they have far less, you know, leg to stand on, but we'll have to see what happens. Obviously, we'll go to court, but I think in the meanwhile, they might try and take action that maybe will placate the people, the big publishers who won this, to say, all right, here's what we're going to do in the future. Maybe that will help take care of it. You know, maybe.
Yeah, and I wonder if this lawsuit didn't start during, you know, before the big streaming boom when, you know, piracy was just rampant and was actually making a huge dent into
piracy still happens and it still costs a lot of money. You would think it shouldn't, but it does, because not everybody wants to pay $10 a month for this, that, and the other.
Now, posting digital screeners for Emmy consideration is a lot cheaper than shipping out elaborate DVD sets. But thanks to the TV Academy, it won't be that much cheaper. The people running the Emmys have banned massive DVD box sets being sent to voters, and everyone is glad. The box sets amounted to huge wasteful clutter, and yes, we're looking at you, Netflix.
They sent like five massive boxes because they had so much programming. They had one, here's our comedy box set, here's our drama box set, here's our special. I mean, they were huge. Oh, my God.
Yeah, they spend a lot of money on their campaigns.
I gave them to the kids and they used them as bricks.
Now producers of shows can choose to provide access to digital screeners on their own website or on the Emmys for Your Consideration site. Whichever one they choose, they'll have to pay a fee. The physical screener fees brought in millions to the TV Academy coffers, and while everyone is glad to see the bulky boxes go, the money was much appreciated. Digital fees will be assessed based on the type of show, so studios will save money, but the TV Academy won't find itself starved of funds. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop because it's a very reasonable change to a situation, you know, going with the flow of future technology, but not, you know, making reason. No, we got to change, but we don't want to lose all this funding, but we can't screw it to you. So I think it's a reasonable compromise that helps everybody. There are some other rule changes that are interesting. You know, you'd always have a show like Handmaid's Tale had the last few episodes of one season air after the cutoff date. And so suddenly they were eligible for the next season. And now they're saying, yeah, you know what? You've got a few episodes left. Don't worry. Those are going to count for that same season. You're not going to have them count over two different seasons. And if a miniseries ends after the cutoff date, they're like, well, then you're eligible for the following year, which means if unless you're an idiot, you're going to make sure your miniseries ends before the cutoff date, or you'll start it, you know, after, because you don't want to have it air as early as possible and people forget about it before the following, you know, season of awards. So there's smart little moves that recognize this world we live in where TV is happening all the time, not during a particular season. So I think both those rules changes are smart. The fees are reasonable. Everybody made the right move.
You know, and you might be wondering, why are people paying the Academy for this stuff? Well, they actually have the addresses of everybody. So you have to, if you're a studio or a network, you have to go to the TV Academy and say, hey, I want to send out this big giant box set to all of your members.
And you get to use it once. Don't use it twice.
Correct. Well, if you use it twice, they'll come back and send you an invoice.
Yep.
Have it your way is a slogan for the fast food joint Burger King. I wouldn't know that because I don't eat there. Right, Michael? It's also the pledge of NBC Universal's new streaming service, Peacock. Following the example of Disney's Hulu, the upcoming Peacock streaming service offers viewers multiple viewing options. Who can be confused? You can access all shows for free with advertising. You can pay $5 a month and see only limited advertising, or you can pay $10 a month and watch everything ad-free. No word yet if you can pay $20 a month to stop them from rebooting Battlestar Galactica when they just did it right, seemingly about 5.5 minutes ago. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. At first I thought, why are they so confusing to offer these? But that's what Hulu did. It gives people choice. Does it devalue or add value to the service that it can be free or can be semi? I don't think it'll make any big difference. Ultimately, you'll reach a lot of people right away if they can download it for free and watch it with ads. So, you know.
Well, they're also trying not to interrupt their current business. It's really hard for them because they can't, you know, say, oh, you know, for $5 a month, you'll get everything ad free, because then all the people like the cable operators and the pay TV providers that they're paying carry, you know, they're receiving carriage fees.
Right. Everybody has the same problem though. You know, Disney Plus has it. CBS has it with their CBS Now. Yeah. HBO has it with HBO Max. So everybody's facing the same issue.
But the way CBS solved it was they said, look, we're putting stuff on that streaming service that isn't even on network television.
Well, that's what most people do. And Peacock will have original shows as well.
Right.
All right.
Now cue the Dick Dale surfer guitar music.
Right.
Yeah, okay. Well, yes, Pulp Fiction and the studio that made it has a new owner. Okay, a new part owner, really. Miramax may have been tainted by its relationship to the Weinsteins, you think? But it's still one of the best film and TV libraries out there. Well, Viacom CBS, now married, has swooped in to buy up 49% of the company for about $375 million. They're paying $150 million in cash, and providing about $45 million a year for the next 5 years as working capital for Miramax to make new films and TV shows. Its current owners will retain control, that being the Qatar-based company BN Media Group. Miramax is the home of Pulp Fiction, Shakespeare in Love, and a whole slew of valuable film and TV properties. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it seems like a big whoop to me. It's an obvious play. You want access to that library. $45 million a year seems like pennies. You know, yeah, what are you going to make? Two films, two low budget films, half a TV show. But, you know, they have, I don't know why they don't want all of it, but maybe they have a contract or codicil that means they can acquire more of it down the road, or maybe BN just wasn't willing to do it. I'm not sure what access they guarantee by buying 49% of the company, but presumably that's all been worked out in the contract. But who wouldn't want to access that for their library?
Well, right, and it's probably a streaming play,
right? Because it's CBS Viacom, right? They've got their streaming service, CBS Now. Right. They want to put stuff on it. Absolutely, they need content on there. You can only show The Good Wife and what's the new one called? The Good Fight. You can only show that so many times.
ICM is laying off some workers. But is it a seasonal adjustment or a sign of the price they are paying for the battle with the Writers Guild of America? We know this much. ICM Partners has fired about six agents, which is about 1% of its 600-person company with offices in New York, LA, DC, and London. They say it's just business as usual, reflecting adjustments in natural attrition and a readjustment in how many writers they plan to rep in the future. The bigger change is that ICM was taking on a $150 million private equity investment for future acquisitions. I can never say that word properly.
Future stuff.
They want to grow, basically. They've never had outside investment before, but it comes in the wake of Endeavor having to cancel its initial public offering. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'm going to ask you, and first, they say they fired six agents and they have about 600 people in their company, but those aren't all agents, are they?
Correct. Some are, you know, assistants. Some are, you know, business affairs executives and lawyers who review contracts. Some are, you know, human resources personnel. So you're absolutely right. They're not all agents. And I will say that they basically said, look, this is around this time of year, you know, agents are always getting fired right after, you know, the bonuses are handed out. They usually get fired as bonuses are being handed out. It's more like a thank you very much. Here's your bonus for the year. And by the way, you know, this isn't really working out. We, you know, it's time for you to go. And so this is, it's very common around this time of year between October and December for agents to be, you know, shuffled out the door.
Huh. And, but the bigger change really is the outside investment.
Yeah. I mean, they have had outside investment prior, but it was more of a,
I thought they said they hadn't.
Yeah, well, they hadn't. They basically took over the company. They had a management buyout to kind of.
Well, that's yeah.
Whereas, yeah, this is kind of more, you know, CAA has private equity. William Morris obviously tried to go public.
But ICM wasn't their big thing. Hey, we don't have private equity.
And that's right. They over the past couple of years, probably the past 5-10 years, they were all management owned. So it was private to them. And they were saying, look, we don't have to please anybody but ourselves. And the only way to please ourselves is if we're pleasing you, our clients.
And we want to make sure we're willing to look long term and grow your career slowly and make decisions that make sense for you, not for the next quarter. And now that argument is gone.
Yes. And they do say, we do not want to be a production company. So we're not doing this the way William Morris Endeavor was, or maybe the way CAA was, or UTA.
But they want to expand. So what do they mean by expanding other than doing other stuff? Buying up sports leagues and model agencies?
I have no idea what they mean by expanding in this regard. Maybe it's, you know, getting into, I can't imagine it's, you know, literary. I have no idea. That's a good question.
Is there any chance that they're not telling the truth and it does have to do with the battle with the Writers Guild, that they're saying, you know what, we don't think we're going to get all those people back. We don't need the agents we have now because we don't have the writers. And you know what, even if the battle ends tomorrow, we're not going to sign all those people back up. Either A, we don't want them, or B, they don't want us.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think you mean the six people.
Right.
I think it probably is a small, like maybe one of those six people, one or two of those six people. It's like, hey, when these writers come back, if they come back, yeah, we're not going to need as many agents in the motion picture literary and television literary departments. So the non-performing agents, let's get them out of here. Anybody that's on a desk, an assistant that's on a desk that's in the training program, let's promote them. We'll be paying them less, that's for sure. Or let's not promote anybody this year. And you know, get the non-performers out.
Cool. Well, that was a pretty insidery baseball thing. We could have put that in that category, but we've got another story there because it is time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Sperling, what's our first story?
Our first story? We have more than
nah,
one?
No, we got one.
Okay, I was going to say, yikes. Okay, well, really, we're talking about Netflix. Big deal or big what? No, just kidding.
How can we not Netflix, talk about Netflix?
Yeah, exactly. They released subscriber info region by region, and investors liked what they heard. Obviously, Netflix has hit a peak in the U.S. I mean, they're pretty much plateaued here because everybody is a subscriber.
Yeah, they got 60 million subscribers, so, you know. Yeah.
It's really going to be hard for them to grow much bigger. But when you look at how it's doing in the rest of the world, you can see how the company is growing and still has a lot more growing to do. Okay, not to go number crazy here. You know me. I like to go number crazy. But here are some of the percentages. In North America, it's up 6%.
Now pause there, okay, because they had a quarter where they lost subscribers and people screamed that it was the end of the world. For the entire year, they are up 6% despite being a very mature business in North America where they've got everybody pretty much signed up. And they grew 6% in subscribers while raising the overall fees. So unlike most territories, their revenue per subscriber, meaning how much money do you make each person subscribe to your business, that went up 11% to $12.36. So they raised prices, continued to grow, and are making more money per subscriber. So people could have quit because
per year?
Yes.
Per year, $12. Okay.
Yeah. So Disney Plus is on the board. We've got HBO Max coming. We've got, you know, Peacock coming. We've got all this stuff happening.
Can I just point something out here? Okay, so you said per year, per subscriber, they're making $12.32, right?
36 cents, yeah.
36. Okay.
More than
$12.36. Let's just call it $12. Round it down, round it up, whatever.
And they have 67 million subscribers.
Okay, so, but now here's, I'm pointing this out for a reason. So every month people pay what, about $14
right,
for Netflix on average?
Yeah.
$14. So all of those $14, including the last month, go toward expenses, go toward the content.
There's no middleman like a cable company taking half of it.
Well, correct, yes. But what I mean is, all of that means basically the amount of money that they're paying for all that content for their operations, their profit margin is less than 1 month because they're only making $12 per subscriber for the entire year. That means, let's say somebody pays, 14 times 10 is 140.
Well, they're making about $160. America, there's a whole world, so don't do that.
Well, no, I'm just pointing out their margins here in North America.
Well,
that's
confusing because they're playing a worldwide game. So don't do that. And also, it's a short-term period where they are making as much stuff as they can because they could see the end coming where people were going to pull back
friends. Well, they're still profitable.
And The Office. Yeah. So this huge amount of money that they're spending year to year, that will not continue forever.
No, what I'm trying... Yeah, well, that's what I was really trying to point out. And you just hit the nail on the head. They're spending a lot of money on content. That was my
They certainly are because they got a lot of growth to do. Give us another territory.
Well, in Latin America, Netflix is up 22% over 1 year earlier. I wonder what that means. I mean, how many subscribers did they have a year ago? And how many subscribers did they have now?
Well, they're up 22%. They have 29 million subscribers.
Okay, so
that means 6 million people were signed up this year, about 22%. So that means they had about 23 million at the beginning of the year. Now they have 29 million. That's about 24 million. So they've grown 22%. And that's what they're up now this year. Their revenue is down per subscriber because it's territories.
Content.
No, the revenue per subscriber is down because they are not charging as much as they were. You know, they're not raising prices on what they're charging people. When you see these other territories and they're adding subscribers like in India and Asia and Latin America, it's because they're not charging the $10 or $15 there in North America. They may be lowering their price to get more people in because they can't reach, they want to reach more people. And they have a lot of room to grow, but they're not going to do it by charging a lot of money. So they are
right. And they also have bigger expenditures for marketing in new territories,
right,
where they have to get the word out. So that kind of chews up some of that revenue per user.
Exactly. What's happening?
And they have to go out and license new content for that particular territory. That chews up some of that.
Now you're in the biz. Do you say EMEA or do you say EMEA when you're talking about one territory that comes up next?
EMEA.
Okay. Interesting. And that is?
That is Europe, the Middle East, and I guess it's Africa.
Yeah. So it's EMEA, EMEA. So in the EMEA territory of the Europe, Middle East, and Africa, what's happening there?
Well, they're up a modest, now remember, you know, they're up a modest 40%.
Now, that's, wow, because that's 47 million subscribers. So they've added about 20 million subscribers, or I'm doing that very roughly. But, you know, that's a lot of people they've added in the past year. I wonder what the heck's going on. Subscriber amount, every territory is down except North America. When you look at revenue per subscriber, it's down 3% to $10.26. But that's okay. That means they're adding more people. So they're reaching new territories in Africa where people can't pay as much. So if you want to sign them up and you're not charging them the $10 you are in England or whatever it may be, you may charge them $5 or $6. So every new person you add, revenue per subscriber is going down. But that's a success story because it means you're signing up more people and they're paying what they can afford. So the same thing happens in music. When you add 100 million people in India, your revenue per subscriber goes down. So what? Those people cannot pay $10 a month like North America. If you want to sign them up, you got to charge them $2. Maybe.
Well, and I would point out again, they're earning money. They're not losing
money. Right.
They're earning money. Yeah. Okay. And over the course of the entire year, and I'm just going to pick EMEA here for a second, they're earning $10.26 while at the same time having to market heavily in those territories because they're fairly new and setting up shop where they start producing content in those territories where they have to spend heavily on new content, which they don't necessarily have to do as much in North America anymore.
Right. And what's the final category, the final territory we're talking
about? What is it, Asia Pacific?
That's right. What are they doing there?
Well, you know, look, again, it's not their home territory, so they're only up 53%.
Right. So Asia Pacific, they only have 14 million subscribers, but that's more than double. So they added like 7 to 8 million people in the last year. They're charging about $9.31 per subscriber, which is down very modestly from 1 year earlier. So they are maintaining the amount they charge each people. They are almost grew by 53%. If you look at the world, they have grown in every territory. They've added subscribers everywhere, up 6% in North America, 22% in Latin America, 40% in EMEA, the Europe, Middle East, and Africa, and 53% in the Asia Pacific. But Asia Pacific, they've only got 14 million people. There's a lot of people in Asia Pacific, and that doesn't include China because they can't get their head in there, but they got a lot of room to grow. 30 million in Latin America, there's a lot more people than that there. EMEA, they got 47 million. That's starting to get more like a full, but they got all of Africa to go. I'm sure that's not deeply penetrated yet. So they've got a lot of room to grow. And advertisers, I mean, investors said, oh my God, you know, we overreacted to the fact that in one quarter of North America where they're still growing and just raised prices and maintained growth. So even if they don't grow anymore, if they can keep maintaining, you know, raising prices and not lose a significant number of people, that's a big win. So their stock has gone from falling to hitting $336 on Friday, which was,
well, I knew I shouldn't have shorted that stock.
Well up from what it will. You wouldn't if you listened to our show.
Darn it.
Well, so your 401k is dead, I take it.
Oh, I see what you're doing there. You're saying I'm poor.
And I'm saying it's time for obituaries.
Oh, okay. Well, in that case, let me tell you about a session musician. And you might say, what the heck is a session musician? Those are the people that you call in when you're doing an album and you're like, oh my God, we need a, well, a viola player.
Or you don't have a band, you know.
You don't have a band. Yeah, or you don't have a band.
Right.
And, you know, I was watching Keb Mo. You know who Keb Mo is?
I do.
Yeah, blues player. And he has a new holiday album out and he kind of brought people behind the scenes. Now, his band is kind of like a catch-all, you know, so he actually brought in a whole bunch of session musicians and a session orchestra. Well, Emile Richards was a well-known LA session musician. He died at the age of 87.
That's right. He was a member of the Wrecking Crew. And you might have heard of that. Like, you look at the soul musicians and the people in certain territories. A lot of people have heard of the Wrecking Crew. There's been a documentary film made about them. He was a percussionist. He played everything, but he specialized in the vibraphone. He loved the vibraphone. And he's one of those behind the scenes talents who seems to have credits that are everywhere and they just kind of blow your mind. He snapped his fingers on the theme song to the Addams Family. That was him. That's kind of cool. He played the bongos on the theme song to Mission Impossible. And he did it wrong. And he made everybody do it over again. He's like, I got off of, you know, a hundredth of a second or something. And he made them all record it all over again because he could hear it was slightly off. And he's like, oh, thank God I did, because it was such a big hit show. He played the xylophone on the theme song to The Simpsons. And Danny Elfman called him one of the great treasures. He recorded albums and toured with both George Harrison and Frank Zappa, two great artists who really know top-notch musicians when they know them. He played on stage a lot. This is cool. With Lenny Bruce, the comic Lenny Bruce. If you watch The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, you're familiar with Lenny Bruce now, the trailblazing comic who would get arrested all the time. And when he went on stage, he loved to have jazz musicians backing him up. They would play before he came on, not talk while he was doing it. It wasn't a Hepcat thing as such, I don't think. But he had jazz musicians on stage, and Emile Richards was one of them. That's pretty cool. He toured with George Shearing, a world-class pianist, at the start of his career. That was how he got his break. And the names of people go on and on. Sinatra, Judy Garland, Linda Ronstadt, Elvis Presley, Nat King Cole, Michael Jackson, the Beach Boys, Joni Mitchell, Marvin Gaye, the Carpenters. So the Carpenters, you know, his music may have burned up in the flames. Think of all the songs he played on that may have gone up in flames at that horrible fire we're just really learning about. He played with all the Newman brothers, the composers, Alfred Newman, Thomas Newman, Randy Newman. These are iconic family and relatives who have, you know, created some of the great film scores of all time. And he was all over their recordings. So Emile Richards had just a very cool career.
Have you ever been in a session where like a session orchestra comes in and they walk in, they are handed their music, they sit down, put the music on the music stand, and they just start playing.
There you go. They know what they're doing. Yeah, they're
badass. It's like their sight reading ability is unbelievable. And even better, the engineers who will say, oh, all right, stop. Okay, trombone number 4, that's an E flat, not an F. And you're just like, wait, what? How did you heard that from the trombone number 4? They're pretty remarkable.
Yeah, they're top pros. The Wrecking Crew documentary is fun. It's not a great documentary, but it's interesting because their story is so cool. So you can think of all the music and albums that you've had. I mean, just the Addams Family, Mission Impossible, and The Simpsons alone, you're going to be heard forever.
Well, you know, why don't you go and listen to some of that music between now and our next show next week? In the meantime, please do subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find us. Please do rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It helps us out when you do. It helps other people find the show when you do that. Links to those ways to subscribe to us, as well as links to all the stories we discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's MerryChristmasWarIsOver.com, which is available.
Well, okay. I'm not even quite sure
what John and Yoko song, Merry Christmas, my favorite holiday song. I was going to say feedtheworld.com, which is a real website connected to Do They Know It's Christmas, the great charity single from decades ago. But Merry Christmas, War is Over by John and Yoko, my favorite holiday song.
Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com? Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.